extend a warm welcome to each and every one that's here this evening, and again express my thanks and appreciation for the opportunity to be here with you tonight. A few weeks back, I was asked to speak in a meeting, and a lesson, a couple or three lessons actually, were requested that particularly develop, and I want to talk with you about one of those this evening. And it's going to be a subject that might be a little sensitive to talk about, and certainly in an environment like this, it's going to be the question of marriage or cohabitation. It is a problem that is significant in our country, and as I was asked to talk about that, I was also asked to talk about problems of substance abuse and some other common problems that we face. For folks that are getting older like myself and even beyond, a subject like this may make us feel a little uncomfortable to talk about. But sometimes what has happened is we've put ourselves in a place where we just don't realize what's going on in the world about us. It is significant. I grew up in the world, and so I'm not ignorant of what happened anyway. I grew up doing a lot of things I shouldn't have done. I know about passion. I know about a lot of things that that are common to man. And I want to talk clearly enough tonight again to be understood. I don't want to step across the line of impropriety. But this is truly a serious problem. And one of the reasons I went ahead and put this projector up is because I've got a couple of graphs on here I wanted you to see. And I wasn't sure whether being set up without my computer, I'd be able to accomplish that. So a little apology for that. But that's why I've got everything plugged up here. And I appreciate your forbearance with that. Again, thank you for being here. You're so supportive and kind. And I appreciate all that you do. As you have heard so many times, my wife and I have four children, a bunch of grandchildren now. And my children have been good children. It was a joy to raise them. I was terribly concerned about those teenage years as they were growing up, because the congregation into which that I had moved, and when my children were small, we were having a lot of problems with young people. And I seriously considered moving before, a matter of fact, I had a call from a place called Beaver Dam, Kentucky, after I was there 2 years. And they said, we just want you to seriously consider moving here. But just right before that, my wife and I made a decision that we're going to stay where we're at. We're going to have problems no matter where we go. We need to put our roots down and try to do what the Lord would have done, and do what we can here. And the Lord has blessed us for that, and I'm thankful. But I say that because we were having plenty of problems at the time. As we talk about marriage and cohabitation, we're not talking simply about a problem that young people have. There are many people that are my age and older who are involved with cohabitation. They violated the marriage relationship sometimes a number of times, and have divorced and remarried in unscriptural and lawful ways. There are a lot of things that we could talk about. But I want to start by making this observation. In the world in which we live in a time where there's no objective universal truth, that everything is relative. Now, that's sort of just a summary. And what that really is a description of what is known as postmodernism. About 10, 15 years ago, people were trying to describe what postmodernism was and did a very lousy job of that. But how that displays out in life and what we are seeing in every direction in the various denominational churches and even in the Lord's church in many places, is this mindset that everything really is just sort of relative. There's nothing that's really, so to say, set in stone anymore. That everything is relative. And if you don't know everything, then you can't know anything. And the only thing that's really wrong is to say that something is wrong. And this is the philosophy of the time in which we live. This is the spirit of the world and a philosophy. This kind of thing is not new. And I'm not a great reader, and I'm not a great learned man of ancient Greece or anything, but I know enough about the philosophers of that day and what they were practicing and what they were purporting and many of the things that they did to see that many of these things were playing out long ago. And the immorality that took place among the Greeks and filtered down into the Romans was significant. And so this is not new, but we need to understand there are objective truths. There is truth. And we talked about that yesterday in studying about 1 John chapter 2 and how John talks about that 17 times in 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John in those seven chapters. And, you know, twice that much in the Gospel of John itself, this apostle of love demarked, if you would, the difference between just what goes on in the world and truth very clearly. And so as we begin tonight, I want you to understand that that's the case. Marriage is much more than a piece of paper. It's much more than a little pretty writing that you hang up on the wall. And as we think about what marriage is, you know, it's defined in Funk and Wagnalls, which is an old dictionary that I have and still like. The state of being married, a legal contract entered into by a man and a woman to live together as husband and wife. The word wedlock is associated with that. And this idea is of marriage is associated from a root word gam, which means to bind or to unite. And so the word gamos for marriage comes from a root word that means to be bound or tied together. And so that's just the root of that terminology. And so when we think about marriage, it is something that has been around as long as time has been around. When we think about this term cohabitation, what it means is that two people basically are living together. They are not bound and tied in a legal covenant relationship with each other as God described a marriage is to be. And again, from a dictionary that I use a great deal these days, Oxford English Dictionary, because I like it because it goes back and sort of looks at the origin of the term at the end of the definitions, which is very, very helpful. But it just means to live together, to have a sexual relationship without being married. Origin of the terminology just comes down to living together, dwelling together. And that's the term that is used to describe what's going on in our society, not only here. Europe has already been doing this for some time. And partially because they have bought into the humanistic philosophy, the spirit of the world that we were talking about a while ago, the postmodernism which prevailed there before it prevailed here. And it plays out there where many people just live in very immoral ways. And it has destroyed much that's going on in that society. And the truth of the matter is much of that society is crumbling. I don't remember if I've talked with you anything about, I think maybe that I have, about the demographics of Islam, and that the most popular name of newborn sons in London is Muhammad. That tells you about the change of society, and that's happening throughout Europe. Part is because of immigration, but part is because men and women live together and because of birth control and because of abortion, and the reproduction rate of Europeans, and if it was not for the Spanish influx from Mexico in this country, would not be at a sustainable rate. And that in a number of years, in the next few decades, Europe will no longer be the Europe that we know unless something unforeseen happens. This cycle that has happened among the Europeans is at such a devastating state, and the numbers, if you crunch the numbers and what's involved, will not be turned around. According at least to all standards and records that have been kept, it's impossible to turn it around. And Islam will dominate in much of that world. And that is a wave that is trying to make its way in the United States. And we, because of abortion, because of the breakdown of the family in the reproductive nature of this country, are really only because of the Mexicans and the Spanish that have come in here at a sustainable rate for our society. Now, that is shocking to me. I mean, I'll just be honest with you. It was depressing to me the first time that I realized the magnitude of those realities. But this is a part of what we're talking about in these problems. And, of course, the root of all this we'll talk about in just a minute. This new morality isn't new. It's just actually the old morality being played out again, being lived again. The statistics and realities of how all this is men can do whatever they want. The ultimate reality is that God exists. He is the governor, the ruler of the world, and this includes the family and the marriage relationship, no matter what men do or declare. Men say and do whatever they want, but it does not change the truth. It does not change the fact that God is the creator, and it does not change, there's accountability and there are consequences. His will stand in the end. And what you read about in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32, is a depiction of what has happened to the Gentile world. And as Paul writes that, he's probably writing from outside of Corinth as he's getting ready to come in there. And you see what happens is they exchange the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature, the creation, that which has been created, rather than the Creator. And when men quit revering and fearing God, men do what they want to do. They rationalize, and they don't even care about, ultimately, the Creator anymore. They do what they want to do. And Romans chapter 1 is a depiction of how bankrupt they became. And I believe that is actually one of the figures that applies in Galatians 4, when God says, at the fullness of time, He sent forth His Son, born of woman, born under the law. That what had been demonstrated is that man, pursuing his own philosophy and rationalization and doing what he wants to do, will not answer man's problems and just creates a disaster in society. And it is one of the reasons that the gospel went forward, I believe, in New Testament times, because they saw the moral bankruptcy and the corruption and the decay that it created in their homes and their lives and their communities, and that there had to be something better. There is a better way. This is a chart, a graph from the U.S. Bureau of Census. The number of cohabiting unmarried adult couples of the opposite sex by year in the United States. A blind man can see that this thing is just skyrocketing. That so many people in this country, especially among young folks, are no longer marrying and being faithful in those relationships, but many times they're living together. I ask one of my daughters-in-law, since I'm getting sort of old, and says, you know, is this a significant problem in this rural community in which we live? And she says, yeah, it's really getting to be a problem. And I knew of a couple situations, and she just listed some more that's taking place in this real little conservative rural community in which I live. It's reality. If it's permeating places like that, it's permeating every place else. But again, this isn't, you know, some preacher that put this together. These are statistics that are being taken from the Census Bureau of our country. Some others that we might notice here. Married couples. You see that is declining. In 1930, 84% of folks were married once they got to a certain age. In 2005, it was 49.7. The divorce rate, if you will notice here, and I did not bring up my little pointer. It looks like I saw one down here earlier. May or may not work. Okay, it doesn't matter. But you'll see what has happened with the divorce rate is actually the divorce rate has been climbing, declining statistically. It's not because divorce has really gone down. It's because people quit marrying. Divorce is as bad or worse than it's ever been, probably. But what is happening is what falls through the holes is there's lots of people that just aren't marrying. They're just moving in together. And these are the folks that are actually making a mess out of their life. And again, a couple more charts. As marriage plunges, you can see to the left, this is a digression in the number of people entering marriages. And this is another graph showing the progress or the skyrocketing nature of cohabitation. People are living together. In some states, after folks live together a certain number of years, they call it a common law marriage. By state and largely for tax reasons, so the government can keep up with them and get more money. In certain circumstances, they have categorized that, but that varies from state to state, and again, lots of various regulations associated with it. But there's just a lot of difficulties that arise. I've got some other things that I printed off here. Last paragraph I want to read here, some of it talks about similar things that these graphs talk about. But it says, a growing percentage of cohabiting couple households, now over 40%, contain children. A large number of these cohabiting people have born children. And it's not just in the United States. I mean, it is a problem. Africa, there's a lot of problems of sexual immorality. And there's problems where a young lady is having difficulties in her home, and so she moves in with some guy. He may be married to somebody else even. And she has a couple of children by him, and she's made a mess out of things. Where do I go? What do I do now? And I mean, it is heartbreaking, and it's heartrending, and it's so in this country, the mess that comes out of people's lives. And I've been around enough of this. I'm not just talking about statistics out of a book or charts that I'm putting in front of you. It breaks your heart to see the mess that people often make out of their lives. And when you sit down across from someone and they're just breaking down crying, says, look at the mess that I have made. Some things can't be undone. We can find forgiveness in Jesus Christ, but there are consequences that happen in when we're involved. And once you start in a relationship and you have children, if you marry someone that's not going to be a good mate and is not going to care for your children, what do you do? How do you resolve that? This is the father of your children, and it is difficult. And with cohabitation, it is extremely difficult. Another point I want to make on here before I go to this is the belief that living together before marriage is a useful way to find out whether you really get along. That's been an argument that folks have made for some time. Well, we want to find out whether we're really compatible. We want our marriage to last. And so, I mean, it's an oldie but a goodie that the devil has used to try to lure some gal into a relationship or some guy into a relationship in this way. But there, as this information says, is a substantial body of evidence. In other words, the statistics, I'll get it out in a minute, statistics again and again and again have verified that that is not so. As a matter of fact, they indicate that those who live together before marriage are far more likely to break up after marriage if they go ahead and marry later. And so from a statistical end of things, that's how it pragmatically plays out. Now, we're not simply concerned about statistics and pragmatism in that way. We're concerned about what's right and what's wrong, what the Bible has to say. I'd like for you to read with me in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, a very concise statement. And I will not describe to you the Greek that occurs here because it is very graphic. And there is no mistaking what is being said here when you look at the terminology that's used. But in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, it says, let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. And so it talks about the holiness and the uniqueness and the sanctity of the marriage bed. That's talking about the sexual union, the lawful sexual union of a husband and wife. God made that as to be a good and a wholesome relationship in the book of Genesis, and made to draw men and women in a marriage relationship closer together, and it ought to. And that's a whole other subject in and of itself. And he says that this marriage bed is to be undefiled. Everybody else needs to stay out of that relationship, that a man and a woman are bound, and this relationship is to be carried between them and them alone, not before marriage, not outside of marriage, but in a lawful marriage relationship. And he says, because fornicators, that means any kind of sexual immorality, that would include sexual relations before someone is married. That would include adultery outside of the marriage relationship. This word fornication is a very broad term, and it means any kind of sexual immorality. That would include homosexuality, by the way. It would include bestiality, which the Old Testament talked about and condemned. It talks about any kind of sexual immorality, fornicators and adulterers. Adulterers is a specific term talking about a man and a woman that are married are having relations with someone other than their lawful mate, is how it's probably best defined. And so fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. Now, there's much more said about this, but that's about as concise as it can be said, and to the point, very clearly. In Genesis chapter 2, in verses 18 through 25, it tells us about the creation. And there it says that God took from the dust of the ground and he made man, and also he makes woman then from his rib. It says in the first chapter that God made both man and woman in a unique way. He breathed into them the spirit that's within God. He put a soul in man and woman. But in chapter 2, he says in verse 18, it is not good for man to be alone. And so what God decided to do is that he would make an answer suitable to the problem that Adam had. And he made a woman. He made a woman that would be a companion. And this New American Standard translation, as it renders a helper suitable, is someone who will correspond to his need, an answer to the need that man had. And woman is made to be a companion partner. We were talking about at supper a little bit in a different context about the relationship of man and woman, that God didn't make man and woman, husband and wife, to compete with each other, but rather to complement each other. And that's what Genesis 2 talks about, is as God made the two to be compatible with each other so that we would be a blessing to each other and we'd be able to help each other through life, through the ups and the downs, so that we can share life together. And I tell you, it is nicer to be able to have that companionship. And you watch a sunset, it's nice to be able to sit there together. One of the fond memories I have is one of the first times that Deborah and I had been able to get away together. Our children were teen, preteen, and they were all four going to be involved with something for a week. And we headed to the East Coast and went to Cape Hatteras, set our lawn chairs out on the beach, and we watched the moon as it came up over the horizon and sat there side by side. And I mean, that would have been okay by myself. But I probably wouldn't have remembered if I'd been there by myself. God made companionship in the marriage relationship. And again, we do what we can to be what we can in a marriage union. It takes two of us. And again, I've talked already since I've been here this time about a lady at home who was as fine a Christian as you find. And she's been what she should have been, kind and merciful, feared God, trying to do. She's so conscientious. When she first became a Christian, she knew that you weren't supposed to eat blood, that the Bible taught that. And so when she would buy her hamburger, she would put it under the faucet and rinse it to make sure that all the blood was out of it. Now, she was going beyond what was necessary, but what that reflected to me is whatever it takes. You know, I may be mistaken about this, but I want to do whatever will please God. And she understands. She laughs at herself about that now. But her husband wasn't a Christian. He died not a Christian. And she did what she could, and it was hard. Both her children are Christians, and I'm thankful for that. But what we see is that God made man and woman in such a relationship here that they could and would be indeed blessed. And it says in Matthew, the 19th chapter, when the Pharisees come trying to trap Jesus and basically says, can I get rid of my wife and get another one for just any cause at all? Can I divorce my wife for just any cause at all? Verse 3. And they were trying to trap him. And he says, have you not read that from the beginning, God created the male and female and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. What God has joined together, let no man put asunder. Let no man separate. God yoked them together is literally the word that's used in that text. And it says there from the beginning that this is how it is. It was established that way in the beginning and has always been God's intention ever since then. Again, Matthew 19, Ephesians 5 quotes the same passage here as Matthew does from Genesis chapter 2 and says this is what God created. In the book of 1 Corinthians, if you would turn your New Testaments over there, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, I maybe should spend a lot more time in this passage than I will. But chapter 5 and 6 of 1 Corinthians largely deals with sexual immorality. In chapter 5 is a very heinous relationship that even typically was not practiced among the Gentiles, that a man had his father's wife. When you go to the Old Testament, you find that it was forbidden for a man to have his mother, and the next verse talks about for a man to have his father's wife. There's a distinction that the Old Testament made there, that along with many other sexual relationships was wrong. It was unlawful to uncover his father's skirt, and that's talking about his mother's skirt, and that's his wife. And again, I'm not trying to step over the line. I'm basically trying to quote some passages that apply to this. But what we find then is that's violated in chapter 5, and they're told to withdraw from this man who is practicing this sexual immorality. In chapter 6, the first part of it talks about brother taking brother to law, but then it comes right back at the end of that in verses 9 through 11 and says, or do you not know that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? And he talks about various forms of sexual immorality there. He says, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers shall inherit the kingdom of God. And such were some of you. But you were washed, but you were sanctified, but you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and in the Spirit of our God. You notice that he says, and such were some of you. I believe that all these categories that some of these Corinthians had been involved, Corinth was the moral armpit of the Roman world. And it was recorded in history outside of the Bible to Corinthicize, meant to be involved with sexual immorality. And so as you read this, they are acquainted with moral debauchery and what was going on. It was a way of life. And we might think about what's going on in much of our culture today, and certainly certain places in the United States where this is so commonly practiced. It's just the way that people live. We have a young couple with three boys that are just doing really well. And they've only been Christians about 5 years or so, but just doing great. Hopefully we're going to appoint him as a deacon here pretty shortly. But they are both nurses. She quit practicing nursing. She's staying home with their children. And he goes to Indianapolis, which is a little over 100 miles away, and works 12-hour shifts. He stays over there for 3 days, and he's able to be home the rest of the time. But he's a real sharp guy. He's done a lot of, and been involved with liver transplants and just a lot of stuff. He's just a real able guy. But they've just said, you know, you wouldn't believe what it's like over here in this circle in dealings. These young people, they're going out and they're partying, they're chasing around with each other in ways. They are living in debauchery. That's the rule of thumb among many of them. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't some good and moral people among them. But their explanation, this is common. They don't understand why this couple are behaving like they are. They're faithful to each other. They're not interested in looking around for somebody else and cheating on the side. They don't understand that. That's the way the world is thinking, and the world that our children are growing up in the school systems and in the workplace. That's the world in which they live. I would say that 9 out of 10 of us would be shocked, I mean floored, if we had any concept of the knowledge that young children have anymore. In junior high level, and even before that. I mean, I felt like I had some grasp on that, but in more recent times I found out, you know, I was pretty slow to understand the magnitude of that. You watch television, you see what they're exposed to in the internet, what goes on socially, and the kinds of things that are openly spoken of that would not have even been spoken of years ago. In Ephesians 5, and I think it's verse 13 or so, things that they're involved with that they do in private, it's a shame to even talk about them. But many of those things are being spoken of openly, brazenly. But 1 Corinthians 6 then goes ahead and says, all things are lawful for me, in verse 12, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. Now that may seem hard to understand at first. He's not saying everything possible is lawful. He just got done saying in the three preceding verses that folks who practice these things will not go to heaven. And here's the best way that I know to express what Paul's saying in verse 12. All lawful things are lawful. I mean, there are lots of things I can do, but not all of them are profitable. Not all of them are the right thing to do. Now, he's going to take off and he's going to talk about sexual immorality, which is wrong. Their argument seems to be, apparently a saying that they had, is that food is for the stomach and stomach is for food. You know, just like we have an appetite and we want to eat, the body is made to eat. The stomach's made so that we can eat, we can enjoy it. And the stomach is made to be able to receive food. Food's made to be eaten. But they're saying also that the sexual drive is the same way. The body has been made so that it can be sexually involved and engaged, and so just fulfill it, just like eating. But you need to understand what he goes ahead to say here, so that's not so. Number one, God's going to do away with both food and the stomach. He's going to do away with this body. This stuff's coming to an end. Number one. Number two, as you go down through here and you continue reading, he says in verse 13, food is for the stomach and stomach is for food, but God will do away with both of them, yet the body is not for sexual immorality. The word immorality here is the word porneia. This means sexual immorality. This is one of the faults, I think, of the New American Standard, is it uses this word immorality in too general of a way. He's talking about sexual immorality. The word is very specific here. The New King James translation, I believe, renders that sexual immorality, which is clear and concise. But rather the body, he says, is for the Lord at the end of verse 13, and the Lord for the body. Now, God has not only raised the Lord, but will also raise us up through his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take away the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? May it never be. Or do you not know that the one who joins himself to a harlot is one body with her? For he says, the two shall become one flesh. This is a quote from Genesis 2:24, where we were at just a moment ago. And then he goes ahead to say in verse 17, but the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee immorality or sexual immorality. You get away. These desires and passions are powerful. And I'll have a chart to talk about that in a minute. But he says here, you don't tarry, don't wait around, don't allow yourself to be put into greater temptation, but rather flee. Verse 18. Every other sin a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man, the sexually immoral man, sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own? For you have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body. Now, it's been interesting to me for a long time. What does he mean here that every other sin a man does, he does without the body, but he who is involved with sexual immorality sins against his own body? You know, there's lots of other sins that people do that requires the engagement of their physical body. And I may not have all the answers to this, but I think there's a couple things. Number one, he tells us by the very design of God for man and woman, one man and one woman for life, as God designed this body in that way to be used, that this is a violation of the very design and creation of man and woman as God made them in Genesis 2. I think that's the driving point that he makes here. But the second thing that he talks about here, as a Christian, I have been united with Christ. I have a spiritual relationship with Jesus Christ, and this is a violation to that order as well. This body has been made for particular purposes and uses. In the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 13 through 30, it talks about a man that has taken a woman, and by that she has been betrothed. And that was like an engagement, but their engagements were very binding. The only way that that could be severed was by a writ of divorce. In Deuteronomy chapter 22, it talks about a young lady, and she's supposed to be a virgin, and she's been betrothed to this man, and they come together the night of their marriage, and she is found not to be a virgin. And Deuteronomy 22 talks about how that was discovered, that if that is so, that she was to be taken out and she was to be killed, because she was supposed to have been a virgin, and she entered this relationship supposing to be that way, and she was not. However, if he has lied about that, then it has the consequences to bring back upon him. It talks about other things. But you notice this idea of the proof of her virginity. She has played a harlot in her father's house. She has violated the will of God in the very creation as God made it, that a man and a woman, that is to be saved and sanctified in the marriage relationship. And in John chapter 4, verse 16 through 18, you remember when Jesus was at Jacob's well in Samaria, and the woman is talking to Jesus, and Jesus says, you know, something about her husband. She says, I don't have a husband. And he says, you rightly say, you know, you don't have. You say, you've had, I don't remember, five husbands, and the man you're with now is not your husband. I mean, there were problems in New Testament's times. It's not like everything was just peachy and everybody was behaving. When Jesus was walking in the earth and when the gospel was being preached, it was a mess. And this gospel was being preached, and people were trying to resolve those problems and to change their lives and to live for the Lord. I want to suggest to you there are serious fruits that come out of cohabitation, divorce, and dysfunctional homes. We want our homes to be what God would have them to be. And we talk about cohabitation again. We're talking about living together before marriage. Divorce is breaking up of a lawful marriage that God has given. And a dysfunctional home just means homes not being functioning as God designed them to be. There's blessings in righteousness, and there are consequences, negative consequences to unrighteousness. There's a man by the name of Will Durant, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with him. He's written extensive history. He's written the history of civilization, and in learned circles, scholarly circles, historical circles, is widely known for the volumes of writings that he has on history. Why that is significant to this point, not that I am a historian or a scholar or anything, is because he knew history and is recognized to have known history and have been thorough in much of what he studied. But this quote is impressive to me. Durant said, "The family is the nucleus of civilization." That when our homes break down, our nation is going down too. A couple of other quotes at the bottom. We see that people are being selfish, thinking of themselves, not of the family or society's good in general. But two more quotes at the bottom here by Will Durant that I like. He says, "A great civilization is not conquered from without until it has destroyed itself from within." It rots from within, and that's what's happening in this nation. And young people, you have grown up in a different world than I have. When I was growing up, you would hear some of homosexuality, but it was barely out of the closet. When my parents grew up, they never even heard of it. They never even heard of it. And if they did, I mean, it was just so remote and so perverse. And divorce was almost unheard of. In my parents' age of folks, it was almost unheard of. A man by the name of Ken Green had told me when he was young, he says, all the time that I was growing up in the town that I lived, he said, I only knew of two divorces. One divorce was someone in my distant family, and the other one was a lady in town that everybody knew, and it was just such a black mark. That's not the world I grew up in. By the time the 60s and the 70s came along, people were in rebellion to authority, and they were doing what they wanted. But notice this quote in Green. The family is the nucleus of civilization. At the bottom, civilization begins with order, grows with liberty, and dies with chaos. When people go toward the liberty to just do whatever men desire and what they want, not what's right and not what's good for society, society is headed to destruction. And again, I appreciate those quotes because this man and his wife were thorough students of history. And these are observations of how this has played out in the course of human history. The Bible tells us in Malachi 2:15, God hates divorce. Proverbs 22:6, bring up or train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, and not depart from it, a rule of thumb. But the responsibility of our homes to train up our children to be a restraining influence upon our children from the time that they are little. If we will not restrain them when they are little from what they ought not to do, we'll not try to train them, then we're setting them up for fair food for the devil. I say that just out of earnestness, not out of meanness, not out of self-righteousness, but just that's how it tends to work. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, fathers, that we are to bring our children up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. We're to teach them, instruct them, and help them. 1 Thessalonians 2 tells us with the tenderness and the concern in which we do that. Passions and relationships are strong. And good young people, I mean good young people that want to do what's right. Oftentimes, the way our dating system works in this country, struggle with these passions. I'm talking about good young people. Not that are trying to live after the world. I want to do what the Lord wants. It tells us something about these passions. And something that impacted me years ago is that Paul talks about in Philippians chapter 2 about Timothy. He says, I don't have a man like-minded. I'm going to send him to you at Philippi. He is a man that cares about spiritual things. He will care about your well-being. I don't have anybody else I could send to you that would be of his caliber. And yet when Paul writes Timothy, he tells him in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 22, Timothy, you flee youthful lust. That impressed me as a young man. If that righteous young man was admonished by his friend Paul in that way, that is a big flag. Now, passions are real and they're strong. Consider the Proverbs. The first nine chapters of Proverbs talk about wisdom and talk about propriety and what's right and living uprightly. But one of the things that it emphasizes over and over and over and over again is this matter of sexual purity and not being drawn out by a woman of folly. In chapter 9 and verse 13, it talks about this woman of folly. She calls and she invites and she says, stolen water is sweet. I mean, you'll have a good time tonight. You'll have a lot of fun. Yeah, you can go sit on the bench and drink Cokes with those other guys if you want, or you can come on down here and we'll have some fun. What about King David? David was a good man. And by the way, you know, he had wives. And yet he was drawn out by Bathsheba. She had her responsibility in this, but David had his responsibility in this. He should have blocked his passions, but he didn't. He just let himself get a little more engaged with his thinking and his passion instead of fleeing, like we read in 1 Corinthians 6. And he not only committed adultery, then he committed murder. And it plagued his family the rest of his life. And you remember his son Absalom, who tried to usurp his throne. He tried to have his dad killed, and they were pursuing him. And finally, when the general killed him, and it came to David, David said, Absalom, my son Absalom. And he says, I wish that I could have died instead of you. That's the pain that comes out of immorality. God's trying to help us avoid pain. And again, another quote that Ken Green stated in a similar sermon, or one I was making reference to a moment ago, was God is not trying to keep us from the pleasure. He's trying to keep us from the pain. And that's a prime example of that. What God has offered in a lawful marriage relationship where two people love the Lord and they've set in their heart to do what is right is indeed blessing. What about King Solomon? 700 wives and 300 concubines. I have sort of tongue-in-cheek said, man, he would have had to have a database just to keep up with their names. Now, who are you? But the book of Ecclesiastes tells us that he did not find satisfaction. And I believe that's what the Song of Solomon is about. This young couple are in love with each other. Solomon is looking after this woman in lust. But it's a rebuke to Solomon and what he has done in all this. And, of course, First Kings 11 tells us about how these foreign wives had led his heart away from God, and Solomon got involved with lots of things that he shouldn't have, in idolatry. And Nehemiah says caused even him to sin. And so we see this matter of passions and relationships are strong. You know, I try to encourage my children when they were dating and all, stay out of quiet and remote places by yourself. Fine, go into the living room here and say, we'll leave you alone, visit and talk. But don't put yourself in jeopardy. Don't put yourself alone back in a situation where you're going to be tempted to be involved and engaged with things. Those passions are so strong. I mean, they're real. Our society laughs at thinking about having any restraints. I go into South Africa and I watch societies dying off because of sexually transmitted disease, especially AIDS. There are many passages would address this, but the problem with this is it's unlawful, number one. Number two, in the studies that I have done and in recently studying for this series of lessons that I was asked to do, I came across even further information than what I had about the addictive nature of pornography. It does literally change the brain chemistry, ultimately more or less the wiring. And the doctor that was investigating and commenting about this says the only way really to typically defeat this is just like you would any other serious drug addiction. That's how serious it is. About 5 or 6 years ago, there was a Promise Keepers meeting. That's just a denominational, general broad spectrum interdenominational group that of men that wanted to be better family men, so a better cut than average. In that, a survey that was done, 53% of those men had seen pornography within, I believe it was a week before that Promise Keepers meeting. Among the Lord's church, there's often, among young people, a higher percentage than that that are involved with looking at pornography. As parents, we live in a perilous time in raising our children. That tells me two or three things as we think about this subject. Number one, about the availability. The stuff that's on the internet is just unbelievable. We're talking about triple X kind of stuff on the internet that's easy to access. I know of a situation some years ago that I was counseling with a woman whose husband was not a Christian who had spent $800 or $900 that month on a credit card for this stuff. Pastors, preachers were asked what the worst problem they're facing in this religious group is. Some have answered this. Most of us don't have a clue that that's what's really going on in our society, and that this cohabitation and all the sexual immorality is imploding around us. The Word of God is clear. It says, flee immorality. Cleave to your wife. God made this relationship good and wholesome, and He designed it to be a blessing unto us. Well, I'd like to say a lot of other things, but I'm going to stop right there. And marriage is the way of God. It's designed as a blessing, and a violation of that is an affront to God. There's a great beauty in marriage as God would have it. We read in 1 Corinthians various forms of sexual immorality, fornication, homosexuality, and who knows what else. And he says, such were some of you. There is no manner of sin in which God is not gracious enough to forgive us if we'll repent and turn away from it. There may be consequences that we still have to live with, but God